financial independence, country shopping, van nomadism, security culture, ethical enclaves, crypto anarchy, legal interstices, survivalism. Join your hosts, Shane and Kyle, as they explore this freedom strategy known as Vaunting. You're listening to the Vaunting Podcast.
And welcome to the Vaunting Podcast, the podcast making you invulnerable to coercion. I'm Shane and...
I'm Kyle!
Since governments are the primary coercers upon individuals, this podcast, everything found on the website, is covered by BIPCOT's No Government License, as well as reuse and modification to anyone, except for governments and the bludgies thereof. You can learn more at BIPCOT.org. So if this is your first time listening to the podcast or hearing of Vaunting, we're certainly glad to have you. But we would ask that you please visit the website, VaunTingPodcast.com. Go to the second tab there at the top of the page titled Start Here and peruse the information available. They'll give you a baseline so you aren't going into this episode cold. And obviously, there's so much content there on the website, a handful at least at this point of, Liberty publications from the 60s to the 80s and a bunch more great stuff to come out of VaunTingPodcast.com. So, yes, Kyle is back. So at least for this episode, you know, hopefully more. But I guess the question I have for you, Kyle, is are you gonna be available to record for the next few weeks or so? Or I guess, you know, hopefully, you know, for a lot longer than that. Are things gonna get busy? At the job in the Serval Society again.
My intention is always to stick around, but unfortunately, when pursuing financial independence, sometimes some things kind of have to be put on the back burner, at least for a little bit. With the so-called holidays coming up and the rest of management mentioning about peak season this and peak season that, and I don't know, I'm kind of getting the feeling that unless they're offering overtime, I'm thinking about kind of ducking out of a lot of it. I haven't yet made a decision, but you know, at this point, I'd rather make money for me rather than make money for a bunch of corporate suits whom I will never meet or even shake their hand while they make all sorts of what I think are terrible business decisions, like telling the vendors to ship perishable goods into the warehouse that end up going bad way too quickly before the customers even have a chance to order it. So, yeah, apparently not all businessmen are created equal. But I think Ayn Rand said something similar in Atlas Shrugged, right? There were characters like Orrin Boyle who are like these corrupt industrialists and they're like not entrepreneurs and so forth. So I don't know, man. It's just kind of like I've really been kind of evaluating a lot of things. And I think at this juncture, you know, I would love to start my own business, but I think before that I need to get into a different line of work. So we'll see. I'll try to keep a close eye on that and try to make more time for things I care about, like TVP and a few other things.
Right on, right on. So there's kind of the employment, I guess, update. But how's everything else going, man?
Well, unfortunately, I've been ill as of lately, so that didn't help. So whenever I wasn't at work, I'd be at home hacking and coughing. And otherwise, whenever I get a chance, I work in like very tiny snippets on my next book, which I was initially trying to have out for Christmas. But yeah, that's not going to happen. So I'm thinking maybe Easter at this point. We'll kind of have to see what happens. You know, if certain things kind of depending how it comes through, whether certain employment opportunities come up that I've already, you know, sent, you know, the resume to potential employers and all that. We'll see what happens. And, if I get more leisure time, so-called time not on a job making money for other people instead of myself, then I can actually have more time to do things I care about. So that's kind of where I'm at. I'm really disillusioned. I already didn't like the entire notion of corporate America, but now that I've been in it day in and day out, but not just like a 5-day, you know, 8-hour workday or whatever, I'm doing like 10-hour days normally. So I'm just sick of it. I'm just sick. I don't want to be here no more.
Right, right. No, I can certainly understand that. And Vaunting Life, you got it edited and back to me. And now we're just now just for the afterwards. So that'll actually be for the listeners who have been hearing that for quite a while. You know, it's here. You know, it's done. It'll be out very, very soon. Hopefully we can make it, you know, kind of a, you know, a Christmas gift you know, whatever holiday you're deciding to celebrate. You know, maybe a gift, you know, a holiday gift for our TVP listeners. So that'd be pretty neat, wouldn't it, Kyle?
Yes, yes. And again, my apologies for the listeners for having that delayed, unfortunately. But also keep in mind, too, the thing is like, what was it, 2.5 times longer than the original Vanu book? It was like 240-some-odd pages or whatever.
Words.
And by the way, as a side note, a little bit of a little sneak peek, and I don't think Shane here would be too adverse to me mentioning this. There were so much material in there and so many ideas that sparked other ideas in my own head that let's just say season 3 just got a lot spicier than it already was going to be.
Right. And you haven't even read the other publications yet, have you?
Actually, I just finished reading the one, what was it, Going Mobile.
What'd you think?
I was rather pleased, but I don't want to say anything at this time because, you know, season 3. So I've been also in between, you know, whether I'm on the so-called the grand 15-minute breaks. Ooh, 15 minutes, enough time to basically go, you know, go take a piss, wipe my ass and read something and then I have to go back to work. Yeah, that's pretty much it. So, ooh, I get my grand 15 minutes. Thank you, Massa. I actually do try to read like a couple pages here, a couple pages there, and I can eventually get something done. So, yes, very impressed. I'm just more impressed by Rayo as time goes on. What can I say?
Right. Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I'm right there with you. And Jason Booth and I have been covering, we've covered maybe a couple articles from Going Mobile. We've covered a couple from Ocean Freedom Notes. And then we've done a couple from Vanu Life as well. So there's still a lot more to cover, though. There's, you know, it'll take us a long time, especially when you consider the season 3 material. Yeah, there's a lot of episodes to record, a lot of you know, important information and discussions to be had.
Yeah, exactly. And as a side note, one of the older employees where I work is he imagines himself a little bit of a revolutionary, you know, and he's like, "Vive la revolution!" You know, he says that kind of. He's a little bit more of a moderate, little bit of socialism, little bit of capitalism type. So I think you kind of know the type, right?
Oh,
I think
he's a controlled schizophrenic then. Okay.
That's good. Yeah. Well, I just mentioned him like, okay, what about Animal Farm? And he's like, what are you talking about? So I had to explain like the entire plot line to Animal Farm, explain what Orwell was worried about, and then said, hey, if you can come up with a solution that would prevent the revolutionaries from becoming the next round of tyrants, let me know. And he's like, oh, think about that. I'm like, yeah, and I'll follow up with you too. And then I asked him last week, hey, have you thought about the Animal Farm paradox? He's like, I did. And he's, oh, actually, he, hold on. He did say, I need to think about it some more. I'm like, yeah, you do that.
Right.
So.
Hoping you forget.
Yeah, really. Yeah, imagine that. Yeah, revolution. Yeah, more like evolution in some sense, right? And the idea here is that, yeah, maybe if we can all have a little bit greater amounts of invulnerability to coercion, maybe that's the evolution in question, so to speak. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Right. I'm considering, you know, I'm considering, you know, kind of laying out. I think I've laid out in TVP once before, and then also in Liberty Under Attack. But I'll refrain here. Maybe there'll be a time in this episode. I'm not sure, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to repeat, you know, things I've already said. Not that that's a bad thing, but we've got, you know, a very interesting episode coming up here. So this episode is titled Vanu and Cities, and the show notes can be found at vanupodcast.com/29. So not an intermission episode. This is, you know, one of the mainline season 2, you know, episodes. So we've covered a lot thus far on this podcast, such as wilderness Vanu, van nomadism, minimalist sailboating, intentional communities, etc. All of those requiring drastic lifestyle changes and, for the most part, strategic relocation or, you know, just temporary autonomous zones, mobility, you know, in general, to areas unfamiliar to most in the servile society. You know, when you're complete, I don't remember the percentage, but the large majority of people are, I guess, I guess relegated to these urban areas. And I'm sure a lot of Vanu listeners are too, you know, myself included, and Kyle, you too, there in Austin, right? So a lot of these strategies we've talked about, you know, where you kind of leave that society behind, you know, may, you know, be strange and unfamiliar to a lot of listeners, don't you think?
Well, yeah, it was the I've even written about this before. It was CIA World Factbook mentioned that approximately, what was it, 80 some odd, 83%, whatever the precise percentage was, well over 3/4 of Americans live in urban areas, cities. Maybe they also threw the suburbs in there, too. So never mind people who live in small towns, never mind people who live in rural areas, and never mind the people in those rural areas who are truly independent in terms of their own electrical production, food production, plumbing, sewage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All that kind of what you would normally think of as basic infrastructure. At that point, you're talking about what? Arguably 5% or less of the entire population. And there's like what, approximately 300 some odd million Americans, 320 million, whatever the latest census figures say. So, yeah, the fact that you have over 3/4 of those 100 millions in cities is not an insignificant detail when it comes to looking at lifestyles and whether changes to said lifestyles are worth anything.
Right, right. And this is why I think I've said this before, I remember exactly when, but I really do think, you know, this topic, Vanu and cities, could be the most popular set of episodes that we do because, Kyle, you know, subjective value, right? A lot of people don't want to go, live in rural areas. Some people, you know, like some things about the city. And you just said, you know, over 80% of, you know, Americans live in cities. So this is going to be a couple of episodes that will certainly appeal, or at least come to the same level as a lot of folks that may be listening.
Yeah, and much like how you were look back when we were doing season one, you were looking forward to when the episode in season two that we've done already on minimalist sailboating and all that. Well, the season two episode I've been looking forward to is the one we're doing tonight about whether it's possible or not to Vanu in the cities. Because the cities are kind of the hives of industry and culture and a couple other things, manufacturing as well, and so on and so forth. So it's not some like insignificant thing, right? I mean, people, you remember when Sam Konkin would mention about the retreaters like running away to the woods or something like that, he phrased it?
Retreatists, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess Sam Konkin was okay living in the cities, I suppose. For his own reasons, maybe the reason he thought so was something to the effect, I'm speculating a little bit here, ladies and gentlemen, but maybe something to the effect of, well, if you're going to engage in counter-economic trading, which of course we've done the episode earlier on ethical enclaves, please see earlier episode on that topic. Whether you call it an ethical enclave or you call it the agora, that your greater probability of finding trading partners would probably be in urban areas, I would assume is what Konkin was kind of making his assumptions on when he was, you know, kind of decrying the, Rayo and similar folk.
Right, right. And I think another reason, too, was, you know, he enjoyed the intellectual discussions, you know, reaching status, you know, where they are. But according to I interviewed Wally Konkin, the author of Agora's Class Theory, well, kind of the author, kind of not. He kind of compiled, Konkin's work on it and just added kind of, I guess, explanations and things of that nature. But I talked to him about it, and there used to be back in the 70s and 80s out in Southern California, you know, like there'd be weekly meetings, in the names of, kind of the great libertarian philosophers of the past. So Konkin, I do think that another reason he liked the cities was that's where you, reach people face to face. Right. I mean, if you want to have it's kind of hard to do that, Rayo style. Right. I mean, that's not necessarily what Rayo did other than, communicating through publications.
And obviously, like, even Rayo himself would mention that he was practicing wilderness Vanu, but that would not necessarily be for everybody, right? So he kind of understood that. And obviously, you know, we're mentioning about real life here and so forth. Let me make just a slight digression, mention about even libertarian fiction. So, for example, like the events in Alongside Night, that's pretty much exclusively happening in urban areas. Whether it's the counter-economic activity, whether it was like Aurora, that underground kind of city mall complex type thing, that was even underneath like another city and so forth. City within a city or city underneath a city, so to speak. If you look at like hashtag Agora. You know, most of that's happening in Germany and in urban areas, whether it was, you know, Berlin or Dresden or wherever else, and even other locales not in Germany were mostly in the cities, except for like one scene that was in a rural area. So there was like a homage paid to finding independence of some sort in a rural area. It was actually on a farm. But and I think they were producing raw milk and selling it too in that novel.
Oh, you criminals!
Yeah, exactly. To keep with the theme, because it was a big thing of actually crypto agorism specifically. But yeah, but even in that novella, hashtag Agora, most of the events that were happening and most of the characters were themselves, you know, city rats. And, you know, there's the old adage about, you know, city rats versus country mice, which I think is very apt for this particular episode of TVP, is that when you look at a lot of Rayo's writings, I guess maybe you could say, I guess you had a guy who was a bit of a country mouse, at least in, to some extent. But then when he's talking about the servile society, a lot of the language he's using and how he's describing it, he's kind of describing a lot of city rats, which for the most part is pretty accurate. You know, I can't disagree with him too much as far as that goes. But I guess what we're kind of trying looking at here tonight is, I guess one way of phrasing it would be, is it possible to be a country mouse surrounded by city rats, for lack of a better way of putting it?
Hey, I like that. I certainly do. And it also is worth mentioning that this is a very little developed strategy by Rayo. He wrote you know, one chapter, a page and a half. We'll read the entire thing for you tonight. But I'm sure a lot of you have already you know, read Vanu Book One. At least you know, folks that I've talked to and communicated with on Fascist Book. I think most everyone, a lot of people have covered Book One, so you've already kind of read this. But we'll obviously, you know, discuss it. It was a very little developed strategy, so that leaves a lot of work for Kyle and I in season three. You know, when we really, really dive into this. But, you know, as is the as has been the case for season two, we're going to look at what Rayo had to say. We're going to obviously define some terms. And in this episode, we're going to look at the individual methods that Rayo mentioned, as well as, you know, just looking at what he had to say. And we'll obviously expound upon that a little bit. But a lot of that will be saved for season three. And when we get to season three, Kyle, Vanu and Sadie's will probably be 5 to 10 episodes by itself.
Oh yeah, easily. I can totally see that. Oh, and one other thing too, before we get into definitions, I think another major reason why even exploring even the possibility of whether one could be Vanu within the cities is because for a lot of people who may not yet be financially independent, such as yours truly, there's not a lot of options to necessarily kind of wing it and go it out in the rural areas. Not to imply that it takes a lot of money. It really doesn't, right? There's guys like Alex Ansari and others.
Van Nomad is a man. It's cheap.
And more specifically, yes. Yeah, of course. But then again, not everybody wants to live in a car or van or RV. So there is a little bit of a give and take. There is some people would be a quality of life issue. Other times it's family, right? Some people, they're not living alone. And even if, you know, even if, let's say hypothetically, even if John wanted to live in a van, Becky might not want to, because that's not the lifestyle to which she has been accustomed, right? There's a lot of shades of gray here. So for whatever my point is, for whatever the reasons are, being able to at least be a little bit vanuer within the cities has a lot of potential for people who were the other methods that we've already discussed this second season might not necessarily be available for. So even if somebody was interested, say, in minimalist sailboating, but for whatever reason, they, even if they're like already, you know, reading books on sailboating and all that, in the meantime, while they're preparing, for example, to do the sailboating, they can at least increase their invulnerability to coercion while they're still in the cities before they go sailboating. So it's also, again, there's kind of like a sequence of events thing kind of going on here too, while they're also pursuing some another method.
Right. No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And I guess it will. I guess there are two things real quick. I do want to mention. I forgot to mention this on. Actually, it's the first episode I've recorded at this new house. The internet has changed, obviously, from Bloomington to where I live now. And it's still 40 megabytes down and like 10 megabytes up. But at the house in Bloomington, we were getting nearly 100 megabytes down. Download speed. So it's not as great of internet. So if you hear any interruption or anything like that, we do apologize. But this is still pretty decent internet. So we shouldn't have any issues there. I guess getting back to it, let's talk about the methods that Rayo mentioned here real briefly, not going into a lot of detail because he will, he won't really go into a lot of detail, right? I guess we'll go into a lot of detail when we get to those certain points. But here are the methods that Rayo mentioned as possibilities. And since you were talking about van nomadism, Kyle, you don't just have to do that in, so-called national parks. You can do van nomadism with city squat spots. I think Alex Ansari did that for at least a little while. Going down the line here, park squatting, which that may be a little difficult now, considering, kind of the spikes in the benches for homeless to deal with the homeless, as has been a very contentious issue. Hidden bed chambers, which you mentioned in previous episodes, in ghettos. A possibility, sure. And then anonymity, practicing the gray man, which Jason Booth and I actually talked about that in last week's episode as a way to practice Vanu in the city. We touched on it very, very briefly, but you can also, I guess, urban anonymity, where you practice the gray man, you practice very good security culture, and you kind of just blend into the environment, which is much like, living in a ghetto, which we'll get into more, but anything there?
Yeah, that's kind of a good overview, and we'll go into more detail on the anonymity, the ghetto, the park squatting, the bed chamber, and the van nomadism with city squat spots as we go along here. But yeah, those are the five methods that Rayo mentioned were what he thought of as practicing Vanu in the cities. But I wouldn't be surprised that maybe going into season three, maybe there's more, but we'll save that for then.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we will. And I think in season three, you might even be able to come up with some new possibilities. But I got to leave you in some suspense so you keep listening, right? not that you wouldn't. Hopefully you would anyways. But let's get into definitions here. And since I'm the lead guy for this episode, that's you're the definition man. So what is urban Vanu?
Urban Vanu is defined as enjoying comparatively more invulnerability to coercion, being Vanuer, within a metropolitan area, despite city psychological pressures.
Yeah, very simple. It's it's just Vanu, becoming as invulnerable to coercion as you possibly can, only within a city. So we'll certainly dive more into that. Now, what did Rayo have to say about this subject? Not a whole lot, but I'll start with this kind of a shorter quote. We'll discuss that. And then I'll read the chapter. Well, we'll see what I do with the chapter. I might stop and we might stop and comment on it. We'll see. It's a very short article, so we could do it either way and it'd be fine. But we'll deal with that as we cross, as we cross that bridge. So this first one, quote: liberation does seem to be easier in uninhabited areas, at least as a do-it-yourself thing, which it necessarily is for the first pioneers. But it is also possible in large cities. Imagine, for example, an old expensive building which appears to be only a private club, but which conceals an entranceway to apartments and workshops tunneled underneath, end quote. That's from Libertarian Connection number 5, November 17th, 1970. And keep in mind, Libertarian Connection was this big, massive publication. I actually found an issue of it that someone took pictures of. I'm going to digitize that at some point. There's some that's illegible. But it was cool to look at the table of contents. So you had Walter Block, like the second article, and you had Rayo in like the fourth. So like I posted that picture on the Vanu podcast page, like, that's pretty neat, right? Rayo, just two articles below Walter Block. He's obviously got his problems, but just somebody with his notoriety today, being placed, in the same publication as Rayo. Just pretty cool, just kind of a side note there. But something that Jason Booth has said often, in those intermission episodes, is that when you're an the more people there are, the more coercion exists, right? In that area. If you live in a big city, that's more enforcers, that's more... that makes it more difficult to become more invulnerable to coercion. But in uninhabited areas or in very, very small cities with, 50 or 100 people, there's not a lot of coercion there. There's not. He calls them limited coercion zones, is kind of the way that he puts it. So I think that's a very, very good point to kind of start off with. Maybe if you'll have a response, I'm sure you will. But, it's obviously easier in uninhabited areas. But what do you think?
I disagree. I don't think it's the number of people. I think it's the density. Consider, for instance, a prison cell. you can, there's only at most, even when they're kind of shoving a bunch of prisoners into a cell, there's not that many, what, four, five, six, however many the state's now doing nowadays. But there's plenty of coercion if the prisoners really don't like each other or they just want to rape each other or whatever it is. So that doesn't take a lot of them, but there's definitely more of it. Or even if it's not something like a prison, even if it's like a bunch of people who technically have their liberty, but they're all like in a one-bedroom apartment, that's a greater probability of coercion automatically, at least I think so, because there's no boundaries. And more to the point, they're all densely packed in tight. You know, also look at, you know, even in certain, I mean, even with those storms that happened, you know, a few months back, I think it was during the latter end of this past summer, when Houston and some other areas got, you know, and I think it was a couple areas in Florida, got deluged with this hurricane and that hurricane and so forth, right? Harvey being one of them. And really, you know, it's like, oh yeah, go to the refugee camp or whatever. And it's kind of like, okay, again, it's not the number of refugees. The fact, I mean, it's kind of like if you go way, way back to like Hurricane Katrina, back at what happened in New Orleans. Oh, yeah, let's shove everybody in the Superdome. Technically, there wasn't that many people, but in a relative sense, it was very densely packed. And the problem with cities is that it's not the amount of people. It's the fact they're all shoved into such tiny spaces. If you had the exact same number of people, but they had more space per foot, then I don't think the coercion would be anywhere likely, and even if it was just person on person crime. So no, I don't know. It's just, I'm not going to buy in these like pseudo eugenic arguments that, oh, there's too many people, therefore Malthus. No, no, just spread out. And that, by the way, as a side note, that's also a reason why I think at some point, especially once the state is abolished, if that ever comes to pass or close enough, then for people to go spacefaring as they are able, because that's another way of branching out, of reducing density too. So even for the environmentalists who are concerned about this thing going extinct or not enough water or whatever the hell they're worried about, it doesn't matter whether climate change is real or not. If people can get off this planet, well, human race's survival is pretty much not a guarantee, but looking a lot better, because there's less of density. We're not limited to one planet. We can spread out, spread out, spread out. And that's part of freedom too. You know, you can be, I guess you can have your communes occasionally and shove everybody in an area, but those are people who already have similar values. The real tricky thing is when you have a bunch of people who don't have similar values, should they really be put in densely packed areas? You know, I'm just saying, whether it's a prison cell or a one bedroom apartment, yeah, I hope you guys really like each other.
Right. And I can certainly understand what you're saying there. I guess I guess it was more so a comparison when we discussed it in previous episodes, like the Siskiyou region versus say Chicago. Maybe it's not the only factor too, but generally speaking, I mean, smaller towns like you know, where I went to high school, you know, government schools. It was a very, a very small town. There wasn't a lot of coercion, minus the property taxes, which are pretty outrageous, property theft. But as far as, the daily tyrannies that we've talked about before, you know, there really weren't a whole lot of them. There was one bludgeoning in town, and he was a lazy piece of shit. And there was an alley, and he would park his car where you could see like the police, so you could see kind of on the side of the car, so you'd slow down before you got to him, so you didn't have to like take the time to write you a ticket, which I appreciate the hell out of that. I don't know about other people. He got fired, you know, a couple of years back, I think. But regardless, I do think kind of like the smaller towns, and also the town nearest to where I'm going to be homesteading, where we go riding and camping, it's a small town of like 50 people, and you know, they don't have police. They have a volunteer fire, volunteer fire department. Whoops, trigger, you know, it's a trigger word for the status. Well, what does a libertarian do when their house is on fire? They can't call the fire department. Shut up. So they have a volunteer fire department, and then there's a county sheriff from somewhere else that comes every once in a great while, but he's not really there. So I guess in some of those anecdotal examples, I do think it certainly is correct that, you know, the less people, the less coercion. If these people are broke, broke, you know, Hillary Clinton welfare whores, and they can't, they don't want jobs. They just live off the, live off welfare. They can't really afford a police department, right? So I think that kind of factors into it too. If there's less people, there's less money to be put into public services. I think that's a very, you know, great thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a lot wrong with that. Although, let me put it this way, though, and this is a little bit more of a local thing. The Austin Fire Department and their various, you know, fire stations and all that have a pretty notorious, and unless you're like a local, you wouldn't know this, but they have a pretty notorious reputation of being really, really late to emergencies of all kinds, whether it's grandma having a heart attack or a fire. And no, here's the reason, a part of the reason why. It's not necessarily that the firemen themselves, government subsidized, yes, are necessarily like lazy in terms of getting their gear on or whatever. Although, depending which substation we're talking about, that very much is an issue. It's also the issue of they can't get through traffic. So they're constantly late, like really badly late. We're talking like over 20 minutes late, kind of badly late, while people are like dying kind of thing and stuff's burning or whatever the emergency is. And so, yeah, that again, I think that's another issue of density personally. Like really, the only time they can actually get to your emergencies is like in the middle of the night when like nobody's on the road.
Right. Yeah,
so,
certainly.
If nobody's on the road, yeah, the fire department can actually, and all the statists can all be really, really happy. But, you know, gosh darn it, you know, even if everybody's at work, but it's during the day, yeah, good luck getting on time. And if it's rush hour, forget it. Your grandma's dead. I mean, I don't mean to sound like a jerk, but it's a problem here. I mean, it's like you really need to be kind of self-sufficient or the other way around. You have to, you know, put out your own fires and or drive grandma to the hospital or whatever. She's having a heart attack or whatever the emergency is. So, again, don't mean to sound like a jerk, but this is the reality of the situation here.
Right, right. No, I can certainly, you know, understand and provide some similar examples myself. But I think it'd be, wise to move on here. That was the first sentence of the first quote. But let's see here. So he kind of lays out, you know, some initial, and this was just kind of a, for some context on this quote, this was just something from the end of an article where he kind of proposed, you know, a couple of things and he develops it more in the article we're going to read next. But it's possible in large cities, an old expensive building, which appears to be only a private club, but which conceals an entrance with apartments and workshops tunneled underneath. I do think that's interesting for quite a few reasons, but just imagine kind of this Venuan underground unknown apartment complex. I think it's a pretty neat idea. But a couple examples he lays out there, but what are your thoughts initially before we get on to the more in-depth article, which isn't really in-depth?
Speakeasies. Remember those speakeasies like during alcohol prohibition and whatever else? Yeah, those would be kind of like, like an underground, sometimes quite literally, right? They had their own structures and so forth, and they had to be as invulnerable to coercion as possible, which wasn't always 100% because remember the speakeasies got raided and such. That was kind of a normal thing. But then there were other ones that went untouched. Either the cops were paid off or they honestly didn't know about them or whatever. So, yeah, when you were reading that, that was the first thing I thought of were the speakeasies. So maybe some inspiration could be taken from those.
Oh yeah, if it's underground activities. I mean, even in the there's another book on Loom Panics. I can't remember if it's Guerrilla Capitalism, or if it's How to Do Business Off the Books. Both you know, great books by Adam Cash. One of them is out there for free. Just go to libertyandertech.com/guerrilla-capitalism to get that one. But I don't remember which one it was, but there was a chapter in there, you know, learning from actual criminals. Venuans could learn some things from them. You know, they have to stay underground. They have to stay hidden, lest they end up in a cage, right? Certainly some things that could be learned from, whether it's actual criminals or folks, participating in vices or just those, you know, selling their bodies for money. What a terrible thing, right? I mean, we should tell them what they can and can't do with their body. That just seems like a swell idea that will just end up greatly, right?
But wait a minute. I thought the sex workers were embraced by the social justice warriors. Wait, I'm confused. There's so much controlled schizophrenia. Are prostitutes good or bad? I can't.
Yeah, are they being objectified or are they, you know, providing a voluntary trans? I don't know. Huh. Well, depending on who you talk to, right?
I don't know. It seems like all the authoritarians pretty much hate prostitutes, but for different reasons, right? Right. So the progressive social justice lefty types hate them because it's the objectifying thing, right? And the conservatives, really fascists, hate the prostitutes because A, they usually use their services, which contradict their whole notion of tradition and family values and so forth. And B,
whores are against the Bible, except wasn't Mary Magdalene one?
Oh, yeah, she was a major one. Yeah,
well, yeah. That's triggered, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, and remember, even you know, Jesus in the good book or whatever was saying that, there no sinner is too far. Even the prostitutes can come back, like Mary Magdalene, right? You know, yeah, he who is without sin cast the first stone, said Jesus. And yeah, I'm like, nobody's stoning Magdalene.
And what's worse here is it a woman who decides, this guy wants to have sexual intercourse with me. He'll pay me $50 to do it. That seems like a good deal. Is that more immoral than, we're talking about conservatives here, indirectly causing the deaths of millions and millions of innocent people? That might be harder to come back from, right?
Yeah, it's and funny you mentioned kind of a war example. It's kind of like, oh yeah, we're pro-life. You know, push that kid out of that, out of that woman. But oh man, the second that kid turns 18, throw him in the trenches so he can get murdered on the behalf of bankers and the military industrial complex and such. Right? That's pro-life, I guess.
right. And they believe that Jesus will return. And you know where he was a Middle Eastern man, right? Maybe they'll indirectly kill Jesus.
You never know.
God.
Yeah, and remember, he spoke Armenian, too, according to, I think it was the old Roman records and such. So that's kind of interesting. So yeah, some of the conservatives probably say, but wait, he sounds like a Muslim. I was like, no, lots of different people live in the Middle East. There's even the Kurds who...
Christians, too.
And just other people in general, although that's getting into a different topic. But yeah, the point being, though, is that, yeah, unfortunately, kind of being in the cities have to deal with some multiculturalism, which, you know, it's not entirely bad if you want to, like, you know, have a greater probability of meeting people who are dissimilar from yourself in more than one way. But then at the same time, it's kind of also like you're also going to run into people who are just bullies and jerks more often than you would in other places. And I've had my share at work, too. So, you know, diversity is not always a good thing.
right. So let's go ahead and get on to this, the final excerpts here. This is from Vanu Life number 5. Oh, what I'd love to get my hands on. And the Vanu Life March 1973, this would have been after that. This would have been probably Vanu Life number 7 or 8, I would imagine. The one that will be coming out here in the next, couple of weeks. But, man, I want to get my hands on all those Vanu Lifes, but the one that we have, Kyle, there are actually a lot of those available for sale. And waiting to hear back from Bert, there's a publication called Dwelling Portably, and I've mentioned this to the listeners know about this, but in case you don't, Kyle, Bert and Lisa, the people who put together Dwelling Portably up until like the 2015, got an email from I forwarded the email to you, but. Might be able to provide you the listeners with some of those copies. So I guess that might be a good thing. You want a physical copy? I think they're selling for like $4.95 flat shipping in hand. Like it's really strange how they do things. Like it's still kind of like I think email is kind of foreign to them. So they're still doing the old school sort of thing. Like send us a copy of your ad to our PO box.
mail order. It still lives.
I don't know. I figured I'd mention that. So yeah, the Vanu Life publication. This is number 5, January 1972. Let's go ahead and get into it. And this is called, very appropriately, Vanu in Cities. Crazy how he came up with that title. So let's get to it. Quote: Most discussions of Vanu living assume unpopulated or faraway places. Concerning urban possibilities, 5 possible approaches come to mind. The first and simplest is anonymity: be visible but not noticeable. Conform outwardly while doing your own thing in secret. Be inconspicuous, as Alan Humble says in his article, but most of Humble's advice concerns what not to do. Where does Humble go to do his own thing? Probably not to his apartment. Renting under a nom de plume does not prevent inspection by landlord or police, or overhearing by nosy neighbors. Humble speaks of children, but I wonder if he has any. He says to keep children out of sight during school hours. I wouldn't want the job of keeping children quietly cooped up in an apartment during slave school hours. Incidentally, I've heard that California has lowered slave age to 6. Regarding Humble's recommendation to avoid paying by check, I agree if the transaction is face-to-face, large, or repeating. But selling small items by mail, like Vanu Life, for cash only isn't feasible, so you are welcome to pay by check. Urban anonymity offers no protection from such dangers as nuclear war. Despite these criticisms, I agree with most of Humble's recommendations, many of which apply to all Vanuans, not just urban anonymites. I love much of the way Humble advocates before taking up van nomadism. For me, anonymity alone was unsatisfactory because of city psychological pressures. I was immersed in an alien culture with values hostile to my own. Whether or not I was especially vulnerable, I felt vulnerable. I know of quite a few Vanuists and libertarians who live Humble's way, but I know none who seem to like it for very long. Perhaps there are ways to cope with these psychological pressures. If you think you have found a way, tell us. But personally, I prefer to live far enough back in the woods. End quote. We'll stop there. So yeah, that would be the urban anonymity approach. And you know, Kyle, I do think there's certainly ways to pursue this strategy of Vanu, but I don't know, man. The city's psychological pressures, no matter how great you are being invulnerable to coercion, I don't know. I dislike people. I dislike the Sacer Vol society, so that seems like it would be quite difficult to me.
Okay, so there's at least two elements at play here. There's kind of the security culture part of it, and then there's the, I would agree, the city psychological pressures. So let's take these one at a time. So there was that article I wrote a little while back, which was the entitled Blending in the Art of the Gray Man. And this was more about, well, the concept of the gray man, which is part which is a technique of the good security culture. And I think that's what when Rayo was kind of mentioning about what Alan Humble said in his own article about urban anonymity, what they're really kind of talking about is being the gray man, right? And hiding in plain sight and so forth and not causing a ruckus and kind of being bland and drab as possible, at least in some sense, right? And, you know, there's different elements to that. It's not just appearance, it's also behavior. And then at the same time, there's also you have to have good situational awareness. And then, of course, as the survivalists and so-called preppers would call it, you should consider having some sort of everyday carry items on you of one kind or another. A little bit of a different topic. I'm only mentioning it here because that would be really being kind of anonymous in an urban context, right? Where you're just kind of like, oh, I'm just, you know, John Doe. I'm nobody special, but yet you can pretty much handle whatever kind of comes your way. And you're closer to being invulnerable to coercion within that context. And I think that's definitely something worth, if not necessarily a lifestyle change, at least learn how to do it. So if you do need to use it or you do choose to use it, then it's kind of like a skill set you've already developed. And I think that's kind of good on its own merits. Regarding
right,
the other...
I guess one point there, and I'll mention Adam Cash again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, certainly these things are possible. And, you know, there are strategies to there are solutions to the issues that may arise if you're pursuing Vanuans in a city. But I'll kind of reiterate this again. I think it'd be very, very difficult. From Adam Cash's, you know, writings, he practiced good security culture, thankfully, but he did seem a little bit like a controlled schizophrenic. I mean, he talked a lot about the Constitution, and the law, and, you know, and there were some status things in there. But at the same time, there were a lot of great strategies that he proposed at that time. You know, the banking and finance world has changed quite a bit. But at the same time, I do think there are some valuable things in that book. But
well, I think Adam Cash.
I don't know. I think he's kind of an example of maybe the city psychological pressures. You know, being very, very good on some things. You know, avoiding the theft known as taxation. And proposing strategies for others to pursue, but I still think that there's that kind of underlying theme here, which you're about to get into, is the city's psychological pressures.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Adam Cash. So I think that's kind of an example where somebody's kind of focusing way too much on practicality and not enough on philosophical grounding, because without a philosophical grounding, it's pretty much, you know, game, set, match. It's pretty much a fait accompli that said individual is going to become a controlled schizophrenic sooner or later, because if they, you know, if you don't believe in something, you'll fall for anything kind of thing. So if you don't have a philosophical grounding, then yeah, of course you're going to start contradicting yourself without realizing it and so forth. That being said, Even if somebody were to practice their urban anonymity and practice good security culture more generally, and being, you know, really good at being the gray man more specifically, the yin to that yang would, of course, be the city's psychological pressures. And it's not just the pollution. It's not just the traffic noise like outside my apartment. It's not just the stress of traveling in the traffic to get to work. Or if not necessarily to work, to run other errands, whether it's grocery stores or, you know, pick any one of the different services that such an urban area provides and so forth that you have to pay for with Federal Reserve notes or preferably with something better. It's not just that. It's also the culture, right? It's the servile society in its most concentrated form, at least in some sense, because there's a whole bunch of people who are essentially pushing this, as Rayo himself kind of put it, an alien culture with values hostile to his own. And that's something you can't really easily get away from, right? I mean, we can have a lot of discussions about infrastructure, whether it's certain types of industries, whether it's more physical things like bridges, tunnels, and so forth. But then there's culture, there's behavior, and so forth, and certain assumptions that people are making. And that can get kind of messy real quickly in the sense of, like, how do you deal with that? So, you know, I mean, me personally, if people were more kind of less densely packed in and more spread out, the ease of which to exercise one's freedom of association and disassociation both, I think would be a lot easier, as opposed to if you're all crammed in pretty much the same area, then even if you do try to ostracize somebody from your own social circle or even work circle or so forth, if you're all packed on top of each other, or shall we say, well, we see each other in rush hour hypothetically or whatever, it gets kind of uncomfortable really quickly. So,
right, I don't know. Right. And I guess one other thing, too, you mentioned the culture. And if you're, I mean, let's look at Rayo for a moment here. So what was he exposed to out in his polyethylene A tent early on, and probably some sort of a troglodyte, more of a troglodyte dwelling, completely underground or partially underground? What was he exposed to as far as culture-wise, or kind of those very dangerous ideas that culture propagates, such as nationalism or war or theft on a grand scale, called taxation? How much was he exposed to that? Well, I would say, you know, unfortunately, it's sad that that this was true. But I'm sure in some of the publications he received, the libertarian publications, he did see some of those things. kind of the unfortunate aspects of culture that for those of us who try to practice Von Neumann City at this point without the ideas being fully developed yet, it'll be season three. It's kind of a bombardment of these things. Any sort of entertainment you attend or partake in will likely, you know, 99.9% chance will be just filled with those very nasty, dirty things that states like to do. So I guess the point here is, got to have a very, very strong mind to deal with all of that. And then secondly, and I get to mention this, Kyle, this is what I was going to say in the beginning of the episode, got to be utilizing that trivia method. You got to have the correct, all of the grammar you can get, come to the right conclusions, and then be able to, you know, make those, you know, turn those conclusions into actionable things. If you're dealing with bad grammar, or just kind of the who, what, when, where, that sort of a thing. If you're dealing with, bad information, you're going to come to wrong conclusions. And then the actions that you take, or the, hopefully not, but the policies that you advocate for will be wrong. They won't be based on truth. I think in order for this to be possible, I really do think those two things are very necessary. A very strong mind to be able to deal with that. And also, gotta be utilizing that trivia method, man. And just in the past, and Kyle, just in the past few months, I've really been digging more into that, more so than I ever have before. And I think that's kind of the main issue. I guess that's the core issue that, that's the core reason why the state of servile society exists, is the lack of the utilization of the trivia method, the lack of critical thinking, and then obviously the government schools and the indoctrination that comes with that.
Yeah, amen to that. And as a side note, I really wish that, you know, at the company I work for, that management would use a lot more of the trivia method instead of lecturing everybody about performance metrics and basically boiling everything down to a series of numbers, which I personally think is really dehumanizing. Because at the end of the day, do the customers actually care about performance metrics, or do they care about their orders being delivered accurately and on time?
Yep, the bad information, bad conclusions, and then the policies that they put forth. You know, you being out there on the floor probably seems retarded, right? A lot of the things.
Well, let me put it this way. It's actually discouraged to take initiative. So there's the official company line, but then they actually discourage it. So there's your controlled schizophrenia right there. And then when I talk to the management and all that, different ones, different levels, different ones, none of them are entrepreneurs of the ones I've talked to. All of them are basically they're not like blue collar either, so-called worker types. They're more like career people that just got out of college. So there's a little bit, I don't want to say classism necessarily, but there's very much a, and then it's funny.
Oh, they've got that MBA, but have never managed anybody. Yeah. They've never actually had a real job. And then they go in there with their higher level indoctrination skills.
Yes.
And they fuck everything up.
Yes. And so, and it's funny when a few of them had started mentioning about like, oh, back in college, I did XYZ. I then talk about my, you know, poli-sci stuff and doing statistics. So I'm a little bit familiar with metrics. And it's funny, one particular conversation, the manager I talked to, his face went white because he thought he could get one over on me because he was assuming I was some dumb hick. Until I actually, you know, started sounding at least halfway competent. And it was just fantastic. And see, that's something too I've noticed when, you know, dealing with city people is that they've pretty – not necessarily have had a silver spoon stuck up their ass, but it's very much – it's on that way where they're very spoiled. You know, maybe not in the same sense of as like the so-called aristocrats are, but it's that same like everything is handed to me on a platter because I breathe kind of thing. It's kind of – that's that kind of mentality that's encouraged by the welfare state. It kind of cuts across all so-called classes, really, where people just think, oh, I breathe, therefore everything in the world is owed to me kind of thing. I mean, that seems pretty constant. I mean, even at my other employer who does the temp work and all that, they're worse. Actually, several of them are actually openly avowed socialists. So if anything, things are better at the warehouse, actually, because at least there's more normal people there on average. But yeah, there's very much that yeah, I think you put it right the first time, Shane. A lot of people, or a lot of those managers, never actually ran their own company. They they think they know everything because they got it straight A's or whatever, and then they actually start running a business, and then they come across someone like me. So, but then again, hold on a second. Side note, I just thought of this. Didn't Ludwig von Mises mention in Human Action something about how education, formal education, I think is what he meant, basically kind of stifles entrepreneurship because education is conservative?
Entrepreneurs don't need college. Right? They just don't need it. So the people that you have, you know, that graduate from these MBA programs, generally speaking, they know just enough to be competent.
A little bit.
But that's just enough to I guess maybe not competent, but just enough to do the job. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much the extent that it goes. I remember in Ben Stone's book, Seditions, Aversion, Sabotage, in one chapter, he talked about there was some sort of phenomenon that's very, very common. But bosses are more likely to promote someone who is less skilled than somebody else because they're afraid of losing their jobs, right? If someone else is more competent than them. You know, they aren't going to promote them. No, I mean, the boss wants to move up too, and he knows that if he promotes John, that, you know, John's a lot better at this job than me. He's going to get the promotion if one ever does come about. I'll hire Jane. Well, I'm not going to be. You know, I'll be because of being sexist. John, we'll do James. Well, I'll promote James because you know, James does just enough. But yeah, I mean. He's a little bit of a dumbass, you know. I'll definitely get a promotion if one comes about.
Yeah, and not to belabor the point too much about this, but the city psychological pressures take more than one form, right? Whether it's certain pressures on the job, or here's actually a non-job related one, waiting in line. I don't know about you guys, but I can't remember the last time I was in a rural area or even a small town where I was waiting in line for anything, even with a local government bureaucrats. There's like no such thing as line.
It's stressful, for the most part.
But in cities, there's a line for everything, even the so-called free market activity. There's lines. Grocery stores, pick a place. There's just, it's density, I think.
It's
just
right. It's go to the gas station. They have one cashier. It's like, God damn it. Why the fuck is that guy back there, doing shit with a pop machine? Get up and serve the customers. I'm sick of waiting. Like, this is stupid. I just want to get an energy drink. Let me get out of here. I got to get to work. Or just kind of, the commuting, which thankfully it went from a 2 hour total commute down to about 14 minute total commute. So it doesn't infuriate me now as it did then. But, once I got off work from an 8 hour shift and the day turned into a 12 hour day with the driving, I'll tell you what, when people fucked around driving, oh man, it's not good for the blood pressure.
No, it's not. And see, that's the other thing too. Even if it's like a day off, whether it's the weekend or something else, and even if you're just, let's just say hypothetically, let's just say you're quote-unquote shopping, let's just say make it like a part-day or all-day thing, it takes a lot of time to go, especially if it's different stops you have to make, for whether it's different errands or even something that's fun. It takes time to get in the car and then drive and find a place to park, then go inside and then do whatever the activity is and however long that takes. And then you have to get back in the car, drive around again, find another parking spot, and it's wash, rinse, repeat. And next thing you know, like 5, 6, 7, 8. I've had, where I was, doing stuff with the wife, we're just going out and doing stuff. Next thing you know, it's like 6 hours later and we're not even half done. And we've had to just like put certain things off because it just takes so long to get anywhere to do anything. And it's like, wow, this is rather inconvenient. So so what these city rats do culturally, where they make everything so quote-unquote efficient and quote-unquote convenient, and then everything takes five times longer to get anything done. Doesn't matter whether it's going to a laundromat or grocery shopping or even something more recreational. It just takes forever to get around to do anything even before you even get there.
Right. So one of the common responses that I've seen is, when it comes to philosophy or kind of freedom, things that matter, outside of kind of the work family routine, I don't have time for that. Well, you with just work, you probably have time for it, but just kind of what you went through on all of that time that's wasted in the servile society, yeah, that's probably why you don't have time for those things. Maybe you should reevaluate. Are you serious about those things? If you are, then maybe make some adjustments. And if not, then keep going on your merry way until you're putting a hole in the ground. But let's get back to this article real quick. Quote: "A way to reduce psychological pressures is to gather with fellows into a ghetto, a second approach to city Vanu. One loses anonymity with respect to the larger culture as one develops subculture, speech, customs, mannerisms, and dress. One becomes a relatively indistinguishable member of the subculture, requiring that any organized aggressor attack everyone or no one." And this is a quote. This isn't Rayo speaking. "All Chinese niggers hippies look alike." And back to Rayo. "This doesn't always stop aggressors. Witness Jews and Nazi Germany, Japanese in the U.S. The recommendations made by Walt Hayward presume ghettos of like-minded people. His objections against moving into the wildlands are directed to retreatists who hope to do it at the last moment, not at Vanuans who expect to live there most of the time." And quote, we'll stop there just for a moment. But yeah, the Japanese didn't fare very well. Americans of Japanese descent didn't fare very well after World War II, did they?
And they were Americans. Americans did not fare well because the racist federal government said, oh, your ancestors have elliptical folds on their eyes, therefore you're basically the equivalent of a terrorist, go into the concentration camps, but I'm FDR, but yet I'm not Hitler. I mean, come on, grow up.
But it can't happen here. Nope.
It did at the same time. That's the worst part.
Trivia method. You don't have the proper grammar, folks. But anyways, I guess as far as the rest of this, I don't know. I mean, I suppose in some circumstances there would be kind of the approach of attack everyone or no one, but what was the Waco? What brand of church were they? What brand of religion were they?
I don't remember. It's whatever some really it was. Specific Protestants sect kind of thing. Yeah.
Right. So I guess it might not be the ghetto that Ray was referring to. Not something that kind of blatant. But still, I mean, there are plenty of examples throughout history where that might not work. And plus, with the increasing hostility from the Saves for All Society, with people just pursuing van nomadism alone, let alone with a group of people. And then you look at, as I mentioned earlier, the spikes on the benches to prevent homeless people from sleeping there. I think this sort of a strategy would be difficult in modern day America, where the Saves for All Society attacks anybody with a different lifestyle than they view as classy or whatever it is, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, back to it. And Ray is going to kind of conclude his thoughts on this approach. I just wanted to mention those couple of things real quick. Back to it. Quote, ghettos are also possible in rural areas. The Tequilma area southeast of Cave Junction, Oregon, is almost a freak ghetto. While freaks may not be in the majority yet, there are enough to render the area unattractive for anti-freaks, causing most land up for sale to be bought by freaks, etc. Analogous to what happens in new black ghettos and cities. How much protection this provides remains to be seen. There have been quite a few arrests for growing, using pot, etc. A bigger crunch will come when substantial numbers of freaks, freak children, become old enough for slave school. Will the Supreme Court, end quotes, I love that, require long hairs and short hairs to be intermixed by busing? Or will it compel kids to cut their hair middle length, with the length set by the majority vote every 4 years, end quote? Man, I love that. That last portion, in quotes. Will the Supreme Court require long hairs and short hairs to be intermixed by busing? Or will it compel kids to cut their hair middle length, with the length set by the majority vote every 4 years? So fantastic. Probably pretty obvious to people listening to this podcast, but I love the kind of the eloquent phrasing that Rayo has for kind of proposing these philosophical ideas.
Yeah, he's basically ridiculing the whole anti-discrimination laws and such, right? I mean, and also the busing laws, which were part of that, right, as well as many other things. So this second method of, for lack of a better term, the ghetto method, is the idea where it's kind of more of a collective version of the previous method, whereas the previous method, it's more individually based, right? You are the gray man, you are kind of, there's kind of an implication that you're alone. Here, though, with the ghetto method, it's kind of like if you got a bunch of gray men together, but not necessarily, they're not really gray anymore. They're kind of like taking on a certain persona or certain shared cultural attributes in any sense. Sometimes skin color, yes, but not always. Hence like the old, all the hippies look alike, right? That's not limited to, heck, that's not even limited to gender, right? Because there's also the women folk, right? So there's lots of different ways to kind of look at this. And so, yeah, the whole ghetto thing might be kind of interesting. You know, it's actually interesting here too. Like here in Austin, there's like a certain segment of the population which is very hipster, very much so, especially in downtown. And you can pretty much see them. So, yeah, if somebody were to adopt kind of like a hipster aesthetic, that could be a type of ghetto of sorts, I guess.
And another possibility that came to mind is, or I guess not a possibility, but something that came to mind when reading this. So the idea would be to, I guess, move into an area, buy up all the land and dissuade any squares from wanting to move into the area. So would this be similar to... there's this really and for good reason in some circumstances. I mean, it's always done, via the local government. They can get more in taxes. They can charge more for property taxes. So they're going to subsidize and all of that. That's obviously terrible. If there's a market demand for it, then sure. But gentrification, where there's this small city and, lower to middle class folks and, these rich folks come in and get grants from government. There might be some eminent domain where, we need a road built here. Can you guys help us? Sure, we'll get paid a lot more money, or we'll be able to steal a lot more money. So sure, we'll do that. So I wonder if that would be kind of an example of kind of, it wouldn't be a ghetto though, right? I guess it would be kind of a, I don't know. That's what came to mind to me, is kind of changing it so that it's you know, the area is unattractive to the folks that, you know, have lived there for forever, and turning it into you know, something else where they can become invisible and just be another one of those you know, I guess squares. You know, the people who buy you know, a house in suburbia, you know, kind of have the really uppity Main Street sort of things. I don't know. Maybe that'd be kind of a counter ghetto. I don't know.
I would say that, you know, I'm glad you brought up gentrification, because that really is kind of the counter ghetto. I mean, the whole notion of a ghetto of any kind based on any criteria whatsoever was that it was always anti-establishment. Not that necessarily any particular ghetto was necessarily ethical or worthwhile, but that it was uniquely distinctive, even between other ghettos, relative to the mainstream culture. So more of a subculture of sorts. And, you know, like, for example, like back in the 1920s or thereabouts, you know, there were Irish ghettos, the Irish tenements in New York City. Those were ghettos. So those people would technically, the Irish would technically be, you know, be called so-called Caucasians, but they weren't part of American mainstream culture, not even a little bit. Even the second generation ones weren't even part of American culture, because they weren't allowed to be, even though many of them tried to assimilate, and many of them eventually did once you got into like third and fourth generation and so forth. The Italian, again, so-called Caucasians from Europe, but they had, you know, the Italian ghettos, again, in New York City. To use another kind of example of a so-called ghetto and so forth. There are the various Chinese ghettos, usually in the on the West Coast in various areas, whether it be Los Angeles or other places, that those would be so-called ghettos. Heck, even the – oh, this is perfect. Even the very concept of a Chinatown. There's even a Chinatown in Washington, D.C., by the way, for people who don't know. The very concept of a Chinatown is a type of ghetto. Or at least it used to be. Now it's just this term that's usually used to kind of have a kind of certain flavorful of a flavor of gentrification, unfortunately. But what it originally was basically a very definable, even in physical space, subculture that was really at odds and different from the mainstream one. The problem with gentrification is that that's now a counter move by the more mainstream servile society to basically absorb and dilute those counter-establishment, anti-establishment ghettos of various flavors. So I know that libertarians usually are very polycentric. And that's where the kind of ghettos kind of more or less by the time – if you look at it like in the aggregate, sure. But gentrification – is basically the authoritarian reaction to that. And unfortunately, it's been pretty successful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it definitely has. It definitely has. I'm glad I wasn't sure. I thought of that. I thought of gentrification, and I was like, I don't know if this is worth bringing up, but I'm glad I did. Glad I did. But let's get to the third approach here. Quote, a third approach involves a blend of concealment and deception. Construct hidden soundproofed apartments and workshops beneath or within an owned building, ostensibly used for other purposes. Since such chambers could be blast, fire, and fallout resistant, this approach offers protection against nuclear attack as well as day-to-day predation. The family of Anne Frank, Diary of a Young Girl, tried unsuccessfully to hide this way during the Nazi occupation of Holland. The hidden chamber approach seems to have much potential, also many problems. I have not attempted it, nor even thought much about it. I welcome the insights of anyone who has. End quote. And you kind of have a – I think you mentioned it in a previous episode of Vanu. But you actually have a – you knew a guy that did kind of have the he did kind of pursue the hidden chamber approach, right?
Yes, yes. This was the car mechanic who was like restoring different cars in that garage that he privately owned and so forth. And yeah, because – he, you know, let's just say the state considered him not exactly acceptable to get loans and all that because he had a legal handicap, which is why I kind of care about, you know, the whole, you know, felon, anybody being a felon is because they're legally disadvantaged and all that by the court system. You know, it's not like he could just go and rent an apartment, right? And that's kind of something to consider. So what are your other options when it comes to shelter? And what he did was that he already owned the building that those cars were in. So he basically had this kind of cordoned off area, which I think had been used previously by the previous owner as like an office space. But he basically converted into basically a kind of a makeshift Like I think it was the equivalent of like a 2-bedroom apartment. And unfortunately, with what time I did have with him, I unfortunately didn't really kind of emphasize about his living quarters because I kind of felt that that was his own private space. But what I did notice from a distance, because I was in the garage a lot, the portion of it, which was most of the building, he had working electricity. He had his own working plumbing. He was also like growing things. I presume it's food, but maybe there was something else. Plausible deniability over here. Okay. He was pretty self-sufficient for being, and technically I guess that was more of a smaller city where he was, but I would say even a more built up, like more larger city, kind of like Austin or even a really big metroplex like the Dallas DFW Metroplex. Or I should say Dallas-Fort Worth. I think like a method like that hidden bedchamber, like what that car mechanic did, I think would be potentially viable. And unlike the previous two methods of, I guess, that kind of gray, purely individual gray man anonymity or the ghetto approach, I think the hidden bedchamber has a lot of potential that I think is rather untapped.
No, I mean, that's certainly an incredible story, and I wish I had, I guess an example like that, a firsthand example where I kind of experienced that thing. Unfortunately, I don't. But I think this is a viable approach. I really do, and if you tie it in with a business, too, if you have an above-ground business, and, you know, as per guerrilla capitalism, again, I'll bring it up, if you have kind of a side hustle that you can do underground, all the better. Like a mechanic shop, if you were to do, work on other people's vehicles as kind of his underground occupation that he did on the weekends or something, and he could kind of tie that in, and he could buy the parts through his business, and that would be something that'd be tax deductible, all those good things. And then also, if he tied in with his business and it was actually at the mechanic shop like it was, I know there's something here in Illinois, and maybe it's more widespread, I don't know, but if there's an actual property. Or I guess if there's an actual home on a property, they increase your taxes. So if you tie it in with the business, then I think that'd be a cheaper route to go. So, I mean, there are a lot of benefits that come from that if you're kind of doing the above ground and underground thing. For pursuing venuance, I think it would be an interesting kind of it'd be interesting. I think, for Freedom Pioneers, I think it'd be a fun way. How can I trick the state? You know, how can I do this? I think it'd be a very fun venture.
Yeah, and like I mentioned in previous episodes, I still like my potential idea, which still needs to be tested, about maybe doing something in an industrial park, either buying and or leasing some space and then trying to see if there's a way to have construct something within the structure itself. Again, kind of like what was mentioned earlier this episode, the quote from Libertarian Connection number 5, where you're talking at that point something like a speakeasy in terms of like the actual infrastructure itself,
maybe like Aurora from Alongside Night, only more of kind of an apartment based thing, not
sure
a wise and sure that'd be another possibility too, but I think that'd be a very interesting approach, and it's not the most costly strategy as far as initial investment goes. We propose in this podcast. I'm sure a submarine. Jason and I figured out the price of there was a submarine mentioned in one of those publications, and it came out to like $3.5 million, adjusting for inflation, and that would have been like the cheapest one available back in the 1980s. $3.5 million. That's what it would cost today. A decommissioned aircraft carrier, a lot more than that, I'm sure. An industrial park. We were looking one day, Kyle. Probably about a year ago at this point, I would imagine, or thereabouts. As far as industrial parks go, there's a kind of a wide varying price there. And for some, if I remember correctly, there were some that were under $1 million. So that's not the actual. I mean. It's actually not that far outside of the realm of possibilities, when contrasting that from like a decommissioned aircraft carrier.
Right, of course. So again, I would assume there's a lot more than one way to skin a cat here. But yeah, I still think that if we're talking about doing urban Vanu, then I think hidden bedchamber is definitely a way that is one type of way to kind of explore that in more detail.
Right. So let's get to the fourth approach here, which I think is also interesting. He says, quote, A fourth approach, build a den or camouflage camp on unowned land, such as a public park. This approach has much in common with wilderness fauna. Major advantage, easier access to city. Disadvantages, more difficult to conceal. General hazards of city, including smog and nuclear threat. A man built a shack and lived undetected for 17 years in a Portland city park, reported in preform inform. Park squatting might be done easiest by Venuans who first develop concealment skills in unpopulated remote areas, then opt for better city access, end quote. So, that's an interesting approach. And I think, as Rayo kind of did throughout his, development of Vanu, moved towards more underground shelters. If you could construct an underground structure on so-called public land, that might not be a bad idea. Kind of as we've been saying throughout this entire, season one and season two, or I guess as you've been saying, why you can't expect to run a marathon before you can walk a mile, right? stealing your kind of phrase that you've used so often, so apropos to this discussion. So as Rayo proposed here, develop the concealment skills, then maybe give it a shot. Probably a wise recommendation.
Sure. In some ways, I think that this approach of the park squatting, I think would be the way to put it, is it in some ways it kind of reminds me of the ghetto approach, but not quite, because I mean the ghetto is trying to become a permanent autonomous zone, right? That's kind of what it aspires to be. Right. Whether it's what used to be a Chinatown. Right. It wants to be a Paz, but it's not quite there yet. It never really got there because it's really just more, an area within a city. Right. The park squatting in some ways, I think it's not even a temporary autonomous zone necessarily either. Right. It says build a den or camouflage camp on unowned land, such as a public park. So, yeah, I mean, I guess somebody could build a shack. Again, the example he gave, the guy built a shack, live undetected in a Portland city park. But then I guess it depends what kind of city park, right? I mean, if we're talking about like a world famous one, like Central Park in New York City, I think it's in Manhattan or somewhere, right? That's not going to work too well.
No, right? there's a lot of traffic that goes through there.
Right. So not all city parks are created equal. However, there are also other parks, like say around Austin, for instance, that are rarely used, or shall we say, they're really only used by the outdoorsy and somewhat yuppified or hipsterfied REI, for instance, right?
So a little bit of the tragedy of the commons, then.
Just a little bit, yeah. But again, so people would be already. But what I'm saying is that even in that sense, it wouldn't be necessarily bad to kind of live there all the time. You just would have to move around a little bit. So that's getting closer to a temporary autonomous zone, is I guess in some sense. So as long as the den or camouflage camp was movable, I think it's probably conceivable that if somebody really wanted to kind of give that a try, they could probably do it in certain areas of Austin. Sure.
I guess maybe from my personal experiences in parks, I don't know. It's hard to visualize a man living undetected for 17 years in a Portland city park. That seems crazy. That seems crazy to me, but, I guess I just can't visualize it. I can kind of walk through in my head how something like that could come about, but, I don't know. Like this almost seems... Like, consider Wilderness Vanu constructing an underground shelter, underground structure. Just consider trying to do that in a city park with all the materials that you would use and how much activity would be partaken in to construct that. I have a feeling it's possible, but I'll have to think about this one a little more, man.
I would say this, that particular example should probably be fielded to Alex Ansari, right? He's a native Portlander, right? Regarding at least the situation here in Austin, I would say if someone wanted to hypothetically experiment with the park squatting approach, maybe better to do that in South Austin, of course, being defined as going south of the Colorado River. See, I'm north of the Colorado River, which is where most of the city is. So from my knowledge of the city parks, I don't personally suggest it. If you go south, though, you have half a decent chance. Not a guarantee, but you have a chance because there's more like parks and they're larger and it's more for the yuppified REI crowd who are backpacking and people who are kind of gone for days at a time. So if you have like these larger parks, even within city limits, that where it's the normal activity is kind of more like a hiking, backpacking thing, especially if there's like campsites maybe, or maybe not. Maybe campsites are not exactly the right approach. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that one's debatable. Then, you know, that could be an option. I also do know that in certain other areas, I'm not going to say where here publicly, that there are certain areas where like there were new subdivisions, but they were in areas that were formerly designated as rural. So there's still a lot of like brush and even animals. I mean, there were some neighbors not too far from where I'm at. Not now, but used to be the case where they'd see deer and moose and some other – or wait, not moose. Sorry, the kid mispronounced it. It was like a rabbit or whatever it was. I don't know. Yeah, as you can see, sometimes some of the city kids are kind of like, I don't know the difference between a rabbit and a moose. So it's like, wait a minute. It had hind corners and it was little and tiny, right?
He was maybe – I don't know. I don't know. Maybe thinking like a mouse. I don't know.
No, I double checked with his parents. It was actually a rabbit because whatever. But yeah, you know, it was just kind of funny that the kid was trying to describe wildlife but couldn't do it because he's always been in like, you know, cities all his life. And I guess as a side note, rabbits.
You see like rabbits exist. You know, even in like the suburban areas, right? I mean, like rabbits are there. Like that's. I don't know. That kid needs a little less government school, in my opinion.
Yeah, amen. But yeah. Long story short, what I'm trying to say is that depending in certain areas of even suburbia, especially if there were new areas that like the developers were just finished developing, right outside those developments, like even in like, shall we say, the shared backyards, there are certain areas that are still got heavy brush, not trees necessarily, but places that someone could hide. And on occasion, I've even found some of the homeless people there. So if the homeless people can occasionally do it, I'm not, you know, park squatting is not entirely out of the question in some circumstances.
I can visualize an example now. So there used to be where I used to work was on the bad side of Bloomington. And there was still some wooded area. And it was infamous for being, you know, kind of a home for homeless people. And that never got shut down by the city of Bloomington, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. So it's a wooded area, kind of what you're explaining. So I conceivably, I guess someone could live undetected there for some time. One, because I mean, why? I mean, that might. I mean, there's kind of a, I guess maybe in some instances, probably most cases, a misconception about homeless people that they're just, you know, violent people that'll steal from you. I'm sure some of them will, right? But there are a lot of folks in the state of survival society that do the same thing.
Yeah, no kidding.
I guess that would kind of dissuade people from entering the area. I guess just average individuals who'd want to check it out. And then it's probably just not a problem the city of Bloomington wants to deal with. It's like, what the hell do we do with this? Well, is anything bad happening from them being there? Is it a major problem? No. Well, we'll toss it on the end of the docket and maybe sometime deal with it. So I guess I can't conceive of something like that. It's not a park per se, but I guess I could see how that could work out. So, all right, let's. I still need to consider that one more, and I think we need to cover each of these approaches in a separate episode, and then ones on top of that. So,
amen to that.
All right, so the fifth approach, quote, van nomadism with city squat spots. Some differences from wilderness squatting. Private land, such as backyards of friends, is probably safer than streets for long stays. The vehicle need not be as self-contained, since utilities are close at hand. Off-the-road performance isn't important. Appearance, conventionality, license plates, etc. are important, end quote. So the slave tax, yeah, definitely necessary if you're going to be in the city. unfortunately, but... this is an interesting one. So I know Alex Ansari did have city squat spots in Portland when he kind of started out his journey. So there are ways you can do it. But also keep in mind, as I said previously in another episodes, you know, the state of survival society has a very negative conception of people living alternative lifestyles. There was one example that I brought up where some lady was pursuing van nomadism in some sort of fashion. And she's woken up with her tires slashed and her windshield broken and things like that. So so I guess that might be something to consider. But depending on the area, maybe they'll be kind of friendly to you. I don't know. I'm sure that's a possibility. But I think he makes some wise points here. And what do you think, Kyle?
Well, first off, for those folks who haven't yet listened to our second season episode on van nomadism, please do so, because otherwise what I'm about to say is not going to make a lot of sense. And secondly, okay, so van nomadism with city squat spots. So Alex did a bunch and still does a bunch of vlogging and such about, living as independently as he does. And, whether he was in certain areas of Colorado or even when he would have his adventures in New Mexico, such as around the Taos area and so forth. Yeah, there were times where, yes, he would be on like the BLM land and park, and there was like a legal, maybe not an interstice necessarily, but a loophole of sorts at least, where you could stay there for, what was it, like 10 days at a crack before you have to get a permit or whatever. So he would do that. And then there were other times he'd go into the city like Taos and other places and just kind of find good places to park for the night. And it wasn't completely unusual in some areas that were a little bit more hostile, like Alamosa, where the cops would kind of give him a little bit of grief, not completely violate his rights or anything, but kind of go, tap, tap, tap at 3 a.m. or in the middle of the night or whatever and tell him, hey, get along the road now, kind of thing. So, how dare you be a transient? Not that you have done anything wrong. I just suspect you because you're living in there, and get on down the road.
Or we got a call from a concerned resident here, and since we got that call, I'm gonna have to ask you to move along. And I think that's probably the most common thing that happens is a complaint from someone who lives there. I would imagine so, at least.
And see, I think that's a form of bigotry, honestly, that people who are rooted to a specific locale. Think that they like own everything outside that locale, and so whenever they see transients, even if the transients haven't done anything wrong, that somehow the transients are criminal types because they're transients. So, I mean, it's the kind of bigotry that like the Romanian gypsies have always historically experienced, because they're a mobile people, right? At least historically, anyway. And anybody who's gypsy-ish, they must be bad people too, even when they haven't done anything wrong. They're still bad because they're mobile. So there's this constant prejudice against people whose lifestyles are mobile as opposed to more stationary. So that I've never really liked that about the Serval Society. Like, it's like, okay, even if you don't want to be mobile in terms of your home being mobile, fine, but why are you assuming that people's homes that are mobile are somehow a bunch of criminals?
Right, yeah, it's the difference in lifestyle. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's van nomadism, whether it's survivalism or prepping. It really, really does not matter what sort of strategy, form the strategy takes. It's contrary to the culture and the lifestyles of those in the Serval Society. I mean, that's what it comes down to, as far as I understand it. And the controlled schizophrenia, the idea that this person is taking initiative themselves, therefore, I'm a slave, I'm jealous of them, they have more freedom than I do, let me just use government violence against them and make me feel better. They aren't doing it, so, I'm fine where I'm at. It's kind of the mindset that I think really is predominant here. And it's unfortunate. It really is, but it's not surprising. It's not surprising in the least bit.
Right. And so I think that in terms of doing practicing Vanu in the cities, I mean, other than maybe the gray man, anonymous approach, like living in an apartment or something, leased under another name or something to that effect, probably the easiest approach probably would be the van nomadism with city squat spots, to be perfectly honest, because, I mean, the ghetto approach is rather quite limited. Yeah. The park squatting also has some issues.
Yep.
although arguably maybe the next best thing, the van nomadism, maybe. And then, of course, the bedchamber thing is still where I would kind of put my two cents, but it requires a lot of other things to kind of fall into place, which I'm saying is not impossible, but it's not something that you can necessarily do tomorrow. The van nomadism city squat spots, you can totally do tomorrow. And that's kind of where it's at least for right now. At least I think so.
Right. And anyway, that was, you know, good concluding thoughts there, although we aren't really at that point. I guess we kind of are. But yeah, a lot of these things will be saved to season three, and not because we are just saving it for season three. I mean, this is something that, you know, Rayo wrote a page and a half in his book, maybe 500 words, and then one quote elsewhere. So this is something that Kyle and I have to develop pretty much entirely on our own. Except we always want to hear from you guys. I mean, what do you think about some of these strategies? What do you think are potential ways, potential, you know, strategies and ways to overcome obstacles for pursuing benevolence in the city? So I guess it doesn't fall all on us, but as far as producing the podcast, at least in, I guess, the foreseeable future. And yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of thinking and talking to do on these subjects. I remember when I mentioned we were talking about the industrial park thing. I think we talked for like 4 hours on Vinyl and Cities that night.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a pretty massive subject. But again, you know, if it affects 80% of the people in America, I think it's well worth our time. But any other closing thoughts, man?
Yeah, two in particular. So I kind of, as much as I like the character, I really do disagree pretty strongly with the fictional Bruce Wayne, a.k.a. Batman, about the whole, Gotham needs to be saved. No, Gotham.
Oh, boy, we're getting into comics, are we?
Actually, I think it's relevant here because a lot of the whole so-called superhero fiction of one type or another. But I think Batman is probably the most crystal clear about it, and ironically least ambiguous because it's obviously ambiguous about other things like human nature and such. But the whole thing about we must save the city thing, we're combating even in the dark, even the Christopher Nolan. It was the second movie, the one with the Joker, Heath Ledger's the Joker, The Dark Knight. The whole thing about we're struggling for the soul of Gotham kind of thing. And all I'm thinking is like, okay, I appreciate some of the themes, I appreciate, you know, some other things going on here, but the actual, like, you know, what's at stake here, at least in one sense, is that they're vying for control of a city. And all I'm thinking is, like, why? I mean, like, the Joker
There's little to nothing worth saving in the state of Servile Society, and 80% of the Servile Society exists in cities, so...
Yeah.
So, and, yeah, I think some individuals, if they... I think some individuals need to be presented with the information, and some of them will take the action, but, I mean, the whole saving thing kind of comes from a... I don't know, kind of this...
savior complex?
It kind of seems like an appeal to authority to me.
Well, of course it is. And I mean, in some ways, I mean, the Joker makes more sense to me. Unfortunately, though, he went really hardcore on the whole nihilistic, let's coerce people all day. But you know, he was right about at least a few things, at least I think so, that people are controlled schizophrenics. As remember, he said, you know, their moral code is a bad joke. Watch when the chips are down, these people will show you what they're really like and they'll eat each other. But then remember, as a psycho, he also admitted, you know, oh, I'm not a monster, Batman. I'm just ahead of the curve. You know, so he knew he was bad, but at least he was honest about it. He was just also trying to expose the hypocrisy of other people as well. So he, you know, it was kind of like the bad guy trying to point out that other people who think they're good are actually bad, just like himself. Although, but at least he's honest about it. So not to go on too long about that, but I think the Joker was a lot more on point there rather than the whole, we need to save the city because reasons. Like, there's no explanation there at all from the so-called other side because it's a false debate. I mean, the city's not worth saving, period. It's not worth saving, and I would disagree with the Joker that it's even worth destroying because, remember, that's what he was more about, because he's a nihilist. So, you know, it's not worth saving or destroying, just like it kind of has a life of its own. So let them nuke themselves and try not to get caught in the middle kind of thing is kind of how I view it.
Right, right. No, I think it's an interesting example to toss in there. But your second point.
Oh, yes. Okay, so this is kind of going more into kind of a different subject about the second realm. I would say this, in terms of developing Vanu in cities more generally, I think what was mentioned in the book, what was it called, the Second Realm Book on Strategy, was the notion about anonymized remote-controlled access control. So in other words, using some stuff you would kind of get from the more crypto-anarchists, whether it's using cell phones to like digitally control locks, for example, to actually kind of have defined borders, in a sense, between of certain physical spaces.
Borders, I'm triggered. Go ahead.
Yeah, really. Borders of sorts. Private property borders is what I'm talking about, obviously. That is a form of segregation of certain areas within, let's say, a city, which is that first realm, which is where everybody's getting coerced. That's the servile society. It's basically the same thing. But then segregating that off into the second realm, which is kind of like where a lot of us live. So in a manner of speaking, where people's liberty and property are respected and so forth. And I think that's going to be the next major development. That's kind of my hypothesis here, looking into the future, is that whether it's the anonymized remote controlled access control or even the further refinement of that, which was also referred to as the anonymized remote controlled defense systems, such as, well, you have to defend those borders somehow, right? Or let's say, if your private nightclub or home gets raided by the cops, well, in order to buy enough time to evacuate everybody out, you have to have certain defense systems that are not necessarily designed to wipe out, let's say, the raiding criminals, but instead more as a delaying tactic in order to buy time for an evacuation. I think that's pretty much a lot of the techniques that were mentioned in that book on the Second Realm. I think that's going to be the more further refinement on Vanu and on practicing Vanu in the city. So I think there's a meeting of the minds there, very much so.
Right, right. And my hypothesis is similar in regards to the Second Realm. I mean, there's a – I don't want to get into this at all. It pisses me off. We talked about this on Libertarian Attack Radio back in 2015 when this came around last time. People are freaking out about it again. So instead of the you know, these so-called government corporations like Comcast and AT&T, rather than them, you know, even though they're so subsidized and controlled, it's not even funny. They're basically the government. You know, handing that over to the FCC directly seems like a terrible strategy. But I don't even care about it. I'm not worried about it at all. And it's because you know, the second realm of infrastructure is coming about, especially when you consider, you know, off-grid energy, which is you know, ever decreasing in price. And then kind of mesh networking for the internet. So and blockchains for the financial, I guess the financial portion of it, right. And also a lot of other things too. So I mean,
yeah, don't forget the whole concept of urban homesteading. And by the way, there are publicly avowed urban homesteads right here in Austin. The only difference for like a second realm version of it would obviously they wouldn't be publicly known, but they would, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're here already in town just because of the ones that are publicly visible. So like even urban homesteads. So instead of going out into rural areas, you just do it in town.
Right, right. So that's another aspect too. And I had Jim and Bakonik back on to talk about permaculture farming and crypto anarchism. And, you know, I guess as part of the second realm, the centralized food production system we have now, you know, there's a solution to that too, and it's called permaculture farming. So, so when we talk a lot in this podcast, I mean, it could be disparaging towards folks in the state surveillance society, and it may seem kind of depressing, but as Rayo said, I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. I was setting sail for sunnier waters. That's what I can come up with off the top of my head. Only I guess in the abstract, setting sail to the second realm. But there are a lot of things that there's no need to be discouraged, worried, fearful. Obviously, keep your wits about you and know your enemy, which is the state, and also, you know, private coercers, those in the state's surveillance society that partake in that sort of thing. But there's a lot to be positive for. There's a lot to be hopeful for. But I don't want to, you know, I always feel strange kind of getting into that mode, Kyle. But when it comes to crypto anarchism and the progression towards the second realm, not the progressive and the not the progression in like the progressive sense, but or like the lefty sense. But there's a lot of positives, man. I mean, things are changing quickly.
Yeah, and it's kind of as a parting tangent thought, you know, I've been even telling my fellow coworkers at the warehouse about, like, holy cow, Bitcoin hit $8,000, you know, just lately, and they're like, what's Bitcoin? So, like, some of them actually, because I've talked to a few of them about it, like, which I mentioned to you before, and, you know, I've now mentioned, because remember, there's the new hires as well. People have only been there for, like, not just less than a month, but also, like, less than a week. We're talking, like, brand new people. I've been mentioning Bitcoin too. So yeah, still trying to kind of, you know, if anything, throw a little bit of a mental monkey wrench in some people's minds, so to speak, at least in some sense, just even mentioning it. Like, oh, you're not talking in, you know, Federal Reserve notes? that's subversive, at least in some sense.
Right.
And it's like, I thought Bitcoin already went mainstream, but yeah, I don't know, man. Yeah, and also, sorry, something else that Rayo kind of mentioned too, and I'm kind of getting into this mode too, which I don't mean to as we're about to close out here, but, you know, it's kind of something he mentioned in one of his, I think it was one of his last articles about how he and, I think it was Helene Hygieia or Roberta or whatever alias she was using this week, right? They tried to like meet other people, try to have a Vanu association, but it was unsuccessful, at least thus far at that time. And it was kind of feeling like they were, I was like a thirsty, what was the analogy? Something about like a thirsty man drinking salt water.
Yep.
And that's how I feel when I'm at work. I'm a thirsty man drinking salt water, you know, and it's like, you know, I'm trying, but like the quality just isn't there, you know, and it's not that they're necessarily bad people necessarily. It's just they're going along to get along, I think, is probably the simplest way to put it. You know, there's a few people that are anti-establishment, one of them being the budding revolutionary. And he and I actually get along great, actually, despite our few differences. But we actually enjoy kind of poking each other a bit. So it's kind of like an amiable disagreement of sorts.
I gotcha. But yeah, so I guess to close out on a good note, as we kind of have been, there's a lot to be positive about, a lot of developments, and you know, the second realm, you know, very, I think it'll ease the issues that might have to be overcome for Vanuing in cities. So anything else, man?
I would just simply say, don't ever give up hope. But that makes me sound too much like a therapist or whatever. So I would just say this, invent your own solutions.
Bingo. Yes. Exactly. So the website is vanupodcast.com. Vanu Life, March 1973, 80,000 words. The publication came out to be 250-something pages. So it's a massive information dump, but obviously take your time reading through it and really, really take that to heart when it does come out. It shouldn't be long. I guess by the time this episode goes out, it'll probably be a week, maybe less, just kind of depends. But keep a lookout for that. Again, if you're new to the podcast, you enjoy the conversation, go to vanupodcast.com/start-here, or just go to the normal website and click the Start Here tab right at the top. And really kind of, you know, I guess start from the ground floor. Because this is a really, really fascinating. I mean, even the philosophy. I mean, we've been the action of it is so, so huge. But I mean, you can't find another philosopher like Ray. You just can't. So thanks so much for tuning in, for listening, and you know, we'll see you next week.